This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Amari, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society. On our very first episode, we're excited to be interviewing Dr. Skye Barbic.
Dr. Skye Barbic is an assistant professor at the Department of Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy at UBC. She's also the research lead at Foundry BC, which provides mental health services, supports, and resources for youth struggling with mental health and substance abuse. Do you want to tell us a bit more about yourself?
Sure. I am relatively new to the West Coast, so I moved here 6 years ago. I'm born and raised from Montreal. I am a trained registered occupational therapist and worked quite some time in Ontario and in Quebec, and really, really loved the work that I did, but struggled immensely with the system in which I was working and the way in which we were evaluating how well it was working. And you know, a lot of the pressure was put on the patients or clients in whom I was working with. So it started a long journey of postgraduate studies and doing my PhD at McGill and coming to the West Coast eventually to find a faculty position here. And really quite pleased. I have two wonderful kids, age 10 and 13, and my husband's an emergency physician and also a faculty member within the Department of Emergency Medicine at UBC. That's who we are.
Great. Yeah. So you've been doing a bit of research at UBC on youth mental health and substance abuse during COVID-19. Do you want to maybe tell us a bit of what you've found so far?
Yeah, so it's really interesting because, you know, when I came to BC, what motivated me to come to BC was this idea of redefining what mental health services and substance use services, which I use that language, could look like for young people. And a really nice opportunity came to work with a gentleman, Dr. Steve Matthias from psychiatry, and experiment to reimagine what this looked like. And so one of the reasons why I'm kind of going all the way back 5.5 years ago now is that I think it really positioned us quite nicely. And when we started this 5.5 years ago, we started talking to young people about what are your needs and priorities and what does it look like for you to have a system that meets your needs, not having you to have to fit into a system that's very adult-based or not really designed for you. So we've worked really hard on working with young people and families and engaging them to understand what is the level and the service model for them and what is the level of care that's required. And we're pretty lucky now. There are 11 of these centers open in BC with 8 more to come. And so 19 communities are fully engaged in this process right now of building foundry communities, but also sort of really talking within their communities about what is important for young people, what are their priorities. So when COVID hit, within Foundry itself, we had to pivot quite quickly to make sure that services were provided safely and then also online. So there came our next big project of virtual care. But it also started this wave of, you know, just a lot of decisions being made without young people. So we had two projects that came out of it. One was that we wanted to be able to interview young people over time and understand what their needs and their priorities were. And so that first project is in collaboration with our colleagues from University of Toronto and our colleagues in Ireland. So there's a similar type of model to Foundry in Ontario and Ireland. And so we are interviewing youth in those three areas and trying to understand their needs over time. So that's the first study. And then the second one was, you know, we're really privileged in the research community that our government supported science and supported a lot of work coming to invest in science to help solve COVID or figure out the understanding of the impact of it. But really quite quickly, it just became quite obvious how tokenistic if they were actually engaging young people in the grant process, or how young people were just totally being left out of the conversation altogether. So we received some support from the Faculty of Medicine at UBC to build an advisory, youth advisory panel and a family advisory panel from across the province, youth across the province, to actually advise and set that research agenda. So then hopefully that we can drive innovation based on their needs rather than some adults making some decisions for the needs of young people.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds like two really good research topics. Let's first dive into the first research topic you mentioned, the survey.
Sure.
Do you want to maybe elaborate on some of the findings you have so far?
Yeah, so the group looks at clinical people who are accessing mental health services and non-clinical youth. And we really, I think the first finding is that how excited young people were to participate in the study. And in order to do qualitative research, it's really important that you have, you know, deep dive into these interviews. And we wanted to have in each region 30 clinical and 30 non-clinical youth participate, and that has been a really valuable process just to see how quickly young people wanted to be engaged right off the bat. And they were motivated, they were scared, and we took an approach at the beginning that didn't want to, like, we knew the answer was young people are stressed out. We knew that. We didn't want that as the answer. We wanted the answer of, okay, so what can young people do about it? Like, what are their solutions? So we found the obvious answer of the beginning, young people were stressed out, but they really led solutions to the problem of terms of being involved. You know, they wanted to be at the tables where decisions were made. They wanted to feel heard. And as the interviews have gone over time, as sort of COVID has progressed, it's increasingly, despite asking to be heard and despite making those recommendations to be heard, feeling not heard, like very rarely seeing themselves presented in the data, you know, very rarely seeing themselves at the beginning, you know, being villainized, especially over the summer. Like, young people felt like they were being villainized in the media as the super spreader, as an irresponsible. Yeah. And they just kind of felt hopeless, like they weren't being listened to. And now, you know, within the schools, and when the fall hit, we really saw trends of young people coming together and feeling a little less alone in that process, and feeling empowered to do things at least within their schools, but also disempowered continuously, just not seeing themselves. So this has been pretty continuous across clinical and non-clinical groups, and in the group that hasn't already connected into mental health services, certainly a lot of conversation about needing to, like, you know, is it okay that I talk to somebody? Like, is this really stressful? And almost needing validation for how they're feeling. Like, this is a pretty tough time. And is it okay that I'm, like, up in the middle of the night and worrying about this? Is it okay that I don't feel like I can focus? And a lot of those kinds of questions have been asked.
Yeah, you touched on a point that I've been thinking of quite a bit recently. We know that there's quite a bit of stigma in general around mental health and substance abuse. We know it's like that in the general community, but I was wondering what your thoughts are and what it's like among youth, whether that stigma is there to a greater extent or a lesser extent, or what did you find?
I'm going to sort of step back and put my mom hat on here, because it's funny, because my 10-year-old son just came home yesterday and he said, yeah, like, you know, his friend wasn't in school. I said, oh, is he okay? He said, no, he came back today. He just had a mental health day. And it was so normal how he said it. And it was just, you know, just had a mental health day. So there's this upcoming generation who really value mental health and balance. And I think that, you know, this 12 to 25-year-old group is this is a priority for young people. And the challenge and the stigma comes with what, you know, the communities in which they live, or the families in which they're in, or the cultural group that they belong to. So they've been taught that it's okay to talk about your mental health, you know, within your peer group or at school, but then maybe that's really hard to actually do at home or within a certain cultural group or within, you know, family or older friends or within a place work where you're working. So the stigma is certainly there for mental health. For substance use, I'm going to just try and correct the term, because by using even the term substance abuse, it's very stigmatizing, because a lot of people use substances. You know, some of our highest paid professionals use substances, and the stigma of abuse, you know, comes with that. And so the concept of substance use just has so much stigma. And in BC, you know, we've heard a lot, especially from youth in Vancouver that we've interviewed, that in the Lower Mainland, I'd say as a whole, like, you know, the young people are very aware that we're in an overdose pandemic as well, and that young people are dying. It's not just, you know, the people who you might stigmatize as potentially at risk for overdose. There are quite a lot of young people across the province who have died, and a lot of adults who have died of overdose. And so what we found, and we're trying to unpin this a little bit, is it's not necessarily about the stigma. It's about, how do I piece this out? Like, how do I process that we're living in two really intense times within our province? There's an overdose crisis, there's a pandemic with COVID, and there's way more people dying of the overdose crisis in our province right now every month. And so it's just a lot to process. And then, you know, add pretty complex political time, add the Black Lives Matter, add multiple social justice movements happening, the environmental crisis. Like, young people are stressed out, and they need to be told that it's okay, because, man, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, that's, wow. We have a lot of things to be angry about and not enough time, I find.
Yeah, I would say that's definitely true. We will be right back on Research Review after just one advertisement, so stay tuned.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
Welcome back to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alirad, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we are interviewing Dr. Skye Barbic about youth mental health in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic. So, Dr. Barbic, I have a question for you. Would you say that, you know, for example, now, finally, with, like, vaccine development, we're starting to anticipate some timelines for the coronavirus pandemic and basically all of the restrictions and the modifications to our lifestyle coming to an end. But, of course, having lived through this whole pandemic for greater than a year, especially for youth such as the one which was in your study, age 14 to 28, we're looking at youth who are going through a lot of key milestones in their life, whether it be in terms of education, high school, university, early career development, perhaps even family and relationship development. So would you say that these impacts from the COVID-19 pandemic in terms of mental health, they might be seen on a longer term basis, perhaps even, say, 5-10 years from now?
Yeah, so the science would tell you that this has been, you know, quite a traumatic experience, and trauma tends to have a side effect. And so you wouldn't think of, you know, are we at war, or, you know, if we had that level of trauma, it's not like World War I or World War II. But it's certainly been a massive disruption at I'm going to use my occupational therapy language, our massive disruptions of our occupations. And occupations in my field are everything that you need to do, want to do, and have to do. And so all of, you know, what gets us up in the morning, it's just completely been changed. And the personal consequences have been significant. But as a group, as a whole, for young people, you know, they've missed, you know, our young people, many have missed high school graduations. That transition into first year university was often missed. And these are experiences that a lot of young people are actually grieving. Like, they're grieving the loss of that. And I'm doing my first graduation on Thursday virtually, you know, and I'm going to make sure I put my regalia on and dress up. But I'm not going to be, I couldn't imagine having worked so hard and not have the privilege of walking across the stage. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of faculties who are trying to make this special. And I'm really proud of our faculty. And I can't tell you what we're doing because it's a surprise for our students. But I think there are so many of these experiences at that level, that student level, that have been missed. And we have to say that that has happened. Like, we have to actually call it out and acknowledge it. But we also have to put in supports to make sure, not just like mental health supports, you know, this doesn't mean we need counselors. We need more, in addition to counselors, we need more opportunities for people once we're able to participate again, to do that meaningfully in the most meaningful way possible, to be able to get out and explore and travel and do the things that we've missed so much. I'm not trying to be the naysayer, but I'm a little skeptical that it's going to happen in January. And I feel like the media is, you know, sort of letting us know that we'll be all ready to go in January. And I still haven't seen the data fully yet. And I certainly would like to. And I think once we see it, it'll take a little bit of time for Canada to get this rolled out properly. But once we're all vaccinated, I think there's going to be a little bit of a numb period, you know, like, can we, and we have to trust each other again, and we have to create chances for us to participate in the way we want to. It's going to take some time.
Definitely. And, you know, I would say that would at least take a few months.
Yeah.
And just another question, your study, which was published in the Canadian Journal of Psychiatry, was published in July, I believe, and the data was mostly collected in April, right?
Yes.
And in April, we would have been about maybe a month or two, probably into like the full quote unquote, like lockdown phase of the initial COVID-19 pandemic. But ever since then, you know, we've now been through summer, we've been through winter, and now it's the second wave, whole new round of restrictions. And really, I feel like, I would say that perhaps, I guess Gurman would agree for me, in March or April, it was more of a, I guess, it was the initial
vacation for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little vacation, but now it's like, the start of the like fatigue.
I think initially, while there was uncertainty, there were a lot of the positive aspects, as noted in your study, that we looked upon, perhaps having the chance to step back from our busy lives, perhaps connecting more with family, going back home, all of that. But now that we're looking at the longer term impacts, economic impacts, work disruptions, online education, where we're close to approaching a full year of online education for children, both in school, university students, how would you say that the effects noted in your study, how do you feel that they would have changed now on this timescale?
Yeah, that's why the second study, we're doing this qualitative dive over time with the same, so we could see these changes over time. You're totally right. Like, I think if I had to write the next paper, it'd be like, the title would be, there's only so much bread you can make. Because I think, you know, that was fun, and we became creative, and so the summer came, and everyone let their guard down a little bit in terms of the numbers, and trying to celebrate and travel, and the new excitement of traveling within the province became great, and some resort towns and island towns never saw such a great boom. And then I think maybe, you know, the fall data that's coming out is, the early March, April was scary. Like, people were scared. They didn't know, there was confusion. And then it became like, let's start making bread and cookies and look at the good side of this. And then the summer sort of, we let it down. And now the fall is like frustrated and getting a little bit, there's a bit of anger. Like, I think that's something that's probably different. People are angry. They're sad. The new restrict, you know, I think the reality that a lot of us can't go home for Christmas or are starting to feel isolated is a different tone. So that's what I'm seeing. None of the interviews I've done this week anyway have shown, you know, that new hope that January vaccine's coming or something like that. People are still cautiously optimistic, but still focus a little bit more on the Christmas period coming up and like, ugh, what's going on? I've also heard, like, I'm trying to be positive here, like, we've heard a lot of people talk about exam or talk about even that online learning, because I want to go back to that a little bit. And it's been a rough experience for a lot of people, but for some people it's been really good. You know, the anxiety of being in class, or, you know, being able to do their learning asynchronously and pause their professor in real time. And they've actually felt like they've been able to grasp the content a lot more. And that's been really neat. And a lot of the younger youth who have been in this cohort system, I don't know if you guys know about this in high school, like a lot of youth across the province are doing a cohort system. So they're only taking two courses at a time. They just finished cohort one or quarter one. And they it's only two courses. So they're not trying to manage eight courses at a time, and they're able to do a deeper dive and a little bit less worried. So there's some positive things that have come out of this that may change how we teach for a long time moving forward. Like, I think healthcare has changed dramatically in terms of how we'll deliver services, you know, virtually. Like, maybe never have to go to your family doctor in person again. You can do a Skype call all the time, or a FaceTime call. But certainly teaching has changed, and the way young people are learning has changed. And I think that's going to be sustained for a while, because it works for some people.
Definitely. One thing I just noticed with the whole like shift to online education, now that we have platforms like Zoom, Collaborate, Ultra, all that, is that in the past at UBC, there's been a lot of discussion whenever, for example, it snows around like snow days, like the difficulties of transportation. And just this past year, exactly, I would say around a year ago, there was the whole threat of a bus strike and the question of how students would go to class and all that. And now I'm thinking is that since professors and students are becoming way more familiarized with these platforms, that could definitely change things. Even when we go back to regular, fully in-person classes, is that whenever something like that happens, say you have a snow day, you could just shift to online lectures for one day. No disruptions to education anymore.
And we make the assumption that everybody learns really well in class. You know, like, that's been my learning. And so in terms of an accessibility perspective, I think it's made it more accessible to everybody, so that, you know, if you want to learn a little bit slower, you could pause me, you know, if you haven't noticed I speak quickly. When I came to UBC, my first gig as a professor, I was so excited, and I had nine 3-hour lectures, all perfectly ready to go on a million PowerPoints. And the PowerPoint projector didn't work, at all. So I had to teach it all without PowerPoint, and it was the best lesson ever. But then I decided to go forward that way, because I thought, you know, I have to prepare my students before they come. And then once the doors are closed, let's just solve the world's problems and learn. And that's been my approach when I've had to kind of go back a little bit again and make it more accessible, but maybe a bit of balance with that, you know, the balance of being able to tape our lectures, which has been really helpful for a lot of people. So they can go back to be able to, you know, make those notes accessible early before class, so people can process it. And really cool strategies. Like, there's been the Learning Center at UBC has been terrific at providing strategies to make it engaging. Because, quite frankly, there's nothing worse than seeing 158 blank screens on your Zoom screen and teaching to that. It's been really tricky.
Definitely.
But, yeah, so on both sides it's been rough, but I think there's advantages.
Definitely sounds pretty interesting. We will be right back on Research Review after the following public service announcement.
If you are sick and have contracted COVID-19, the BC Center for Disease Control recommends staying home from work, school, and away from other public places. If you must go out, avoid using any kind of public transportation, ride sharing, or taxis. Monitor your symptoms carefully. If your symptoms get worse, call your healthcare provider immediately. Get plenty of rest. Stay hydrated. If you have a medical appointment, call the healthcare provider ahead of time and tell them that you have or may have COVID-19. For medical emergencies, call 911 and notify the dispatch personnel that you have or may have COVID-19. Cover your coughs and sneezes. Wash your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds, or clean your hands with an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. As much as possible, stay in a specific room and away from other people in your home. Also, you should use a separate bathroom if available. If you need to be around other people in or outside of the home, always wear a face mask. Avoid sharing personal items with other people in your household, like dishes, towels, towels, and bedding. Make sure all personal items are cleaned with general cleaning products after use. Clean all surfaces that are touched often, like counters, tabletops, and doorknobs. Use household cleaning sprays or wipes according to the label instructions.
Welcome back to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC. My name is Ali Rod, and along with my host, Gurman Gill, today we are interviewing Dr. Sky Barbic, a researcher in UBC's Faculty of Medicine. And today we've been asking Dr. Barbic a lot about the impacts that the COVID-19 pandemic have had on youth mental health and a little bit of her research. So I think, Gurman, now you have a question for Dr. Barbic.
And to elaborate on a point that Ali Rod made earlier in the interview, your study focuses on a wide age range of people. We're talking like kids in high school to university to employment. Like some kids have not even hit puberty yet, while others may be married. It's a huge range. And how do you think the mental health needs vary between those different age groups in your study?
Hey, thanks for picking that up. First of all, like one of the most understudied group of groups at all is that 12 to 15 year old group. So we're trying to pay particular attention to that group. It tends to just be an ethics thing. It's easier to consent people in 16 and over, but that 12 to 15 year old group is, you know, transitioning, at least in British Columbia, often from elementary to middle or elementary to high school. I don't know if you ever want to go back to that age, but I certainly don't. That's a really like tough period of transitioning, usually locations, friends, and social groups. So that group has focused a lot on that transition and trying to manage emotions and new feelings and new friends and a lot of new stuff. That 16 to 18 year old group is like trying to find their place in the world and trying to figure out where they belong. And I'd say like the 12 to 15 and that 16 to 18 year old group, there's not a lot of variance in what they're saying. Like it's pretty consistent, you know, that experience, although some people have had very dramatically different experiences, but on average, it's pretty consistent. Once you get into that 18 to 24 year old range, like everyone shoots off in as many different directions as a fireworks show. And so there's a lot of different stories and these stories are driven by, you know, the youth that wants to travel the world, the youth that wants to become a doctor overnight, the youth that, you know, really struggles and finds their way into extraordinary poverty or homelessness and substance use. And so the stories are really, really quite dramatically different. But all of it is in a period of transition where young people are trying to become independent and become adults. And that's where they're commonly striving towards. It's just the pathway there is quite a different journey for everybody. Add COVID to it. It's just quite funky. So, you know, there's an interesting trend in that older group about a lot of like different online learning and different and we've seen this in different pandemics or when there's crisis, people go back to education. So taking more education and sort of coping through doing online learning and different specialty courses, like Dan Levy from Schitt's Creek took a course through Athabasca University on Indigenous people in Canada, and overnight like 280,000 people signed up for the course. You know what I mean? So it's pretty cool.
That's definitely a good point, because, you know, personally at the beginning of the pandemic I was thinking about perhaps like taking a year off from studying and maybe even going working, but then I realized that, especially given the state of the economy, being in the education system right now is probably the best way to really wait things out.
Yeah, it's certainly not the first time that's happened. We've seen it too in provinces like Alberta, when the oil prices and there's a rapid job loss, it tends to go into an area where people go to, you know, University of Alberta shown spikes when oil prices go down, registration at U of A goes up. I'm not sure what that looks like in our province, but it certainly is a common trend. Sorry, I'm at the hospital, so there's going to be a close
call. That's all right. And I think one thing we touched on earlier, of course, is technology, especially how technology is being used for online learning. And technology can be used in a lot of positive ways. We see through video chats, and social media is helping people stay connected while still being physically distant. But at the same time, I noticed that in your study was mentioned that the vast majority of youth mentioned that they're getting their information about the coronavirus pandemic from online news sources, social media, and TV news. Mm-hmm. And what effect do you think that has, especially as nowadays, for example, we're seeing like the whole phenomenon of, you know, fake news and conspiracy theories being promoted by certain world leaders surrounding the coronavirus pandemic. And again, at the same time, there's just the whole being, I guess, bombarded daily by coronavirus news and case counts and death counts, and that could fuel anxiety as well.
Yeah, so certainly, you know, I have to like check my own biases here and check my own biases, because, you know, the hypothesis is that more social media time or more time on online platforms leads to higher levels of anxiety and depression in young people. And that's been shown in some epidemiological studies. And but when you talk to young people and you talk to them directly and you spend some really good time listening, for most young people, like, that would be really the real social network. Like, it's online, and ways of communicating are online. Like, the gaming community, you know, it's a whole different world that I've never been exposed to until this year, until I've understood it and understood that the relationships that are there may be perceived as not real by some adults, but they're legitimately mm-hmm. real, and they're important, and they're different than, you know, relationship I had growing up in my community, because I never had access to that. But this is legitimately real. So ways of staying connected. These communities were here before COVID, you know, like, I think that's one thing I want to recognize, is that we were using online ways of communicating, and the young people were more than any other age group. It's just that this has been, now the news feed is just filled with different things. So you're no longer looking at TikTok dog videos. The TikTok dog videos are interrupted by Bonnie Henry updates all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think you can go anywhere without it being interrupted into your news feed somehow in some way. So surely that has to add up. My 13-year-old daughter has put our family on a digital diet, and so we have to check our phones in at 7 o'clock and turn them off for the evening. And it's done great things for us, certainly, but that's not where my whole social world is right now. Or I feel like my social world's just me and my kids and my husband and my two dogs right now, and my students. But to, you know, the idea of us doing that as a family was really important, mm-hmm. just because we were being bombarded by it, and we were like, you know, our big excitement of the day was the National was on at 10 o'clock or Bonnie Henry's update at 3 o'clock. Like, we had to change our theory a little bit for why we were living for each day. So we're doing some interesting work right now, though, with a wonderful PhD student who was supposed to be in London this year doing his studies at the London School of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. And he's just really looking at the trends in accessing these news and media sources. And it's just, you know, it was so stable and low. It just has gone through the roof since March. So we're not just like, we didn't just do it in March. We like maintained that level of engagement with the news, and it's much higher than it was in March. And so I guess I'm trying to be strength focused. I guess it's great that young people are empowered, but if they're checking the news all the time, they've got to see people like you guys on the radio who are reflected, and it has to look and sound like them. And it hasn't really been, you know, they're getting the news from political figures who don't look like them or sound like them, or they don't see the results of the things that they need in the news. So it becomes frustrating. It can be spiraling a bit. So we need you guys to be on the evening.
It feels like technology. Technology seems to be like an unavoidable part of our lives. And
comes with good and bad. Do you think there are ways or strategies we can use to more healthily use technology?
Yeah, so good. I mean, we have had people connecting in since Foundry has opened up their virtual care service. It was interesting because the people who were receiving care in person still wanted to receive care in person. But when virtual care became, it became this gateway for people to connect into services because they wanted it not by Zoom, you know, or Skype, but by text. And there's different ways that we were providing services, really quite neat, like using messaging to reach out and that as the first step. So that's been a really positive thing. Technology has completely revolutionized how we provide healthcare in so many ways across the board, all health conditions. I'm not sure, you know, I don't know what you guys, if you have this update that comes on your phone once a week, but mine's on Sunday morning that tells me my metrics of how many hours I've been on my phone every day. And every time it comes, I don't even look at it anymore. I just turn it off. Just don't even, it's like weighing in on a bathroom scale and just hoping it's broken. But I've certainly, you know, realized that even that month, that report card is not changing my behaviors right now. So trying to schedule, you know, set some ground rules like my 13-year-old daughter did, you know, with your friends. If you're with your friends, maybe check your phones in the car or leave them there and just spend some good time if you're walking, or try to be present as much as possible, because they're just so distracting right now, and we need some good time to focus and some good deep thinking time. And I think not a lot of us have had that because of social media for quite a bit of time.
Definitely. I've been trying to definitely like use my phone a lot less, because I've noticed perhaps like in the past few weeks I've been developing a lot of neck pain.
Yeah. I've had this on all day. Yeah.
It's probably also related to like lack of physical activity these days with the weather, not being able to go outside and all that.
Yeah, from definitely. Yeah, I think physically, we just finished another study, and we actually asked young people about their pain too. So there's a question about their levels of pain, and their pain is people are, a lot of young people are reporting a lot more pain than they should be for this age group. So we're feeling it. And you know, when you're, sometimes mental health challenges also present in different ways, you know, and I think if you're holding stress in various parts of your body, it can result in pain. And so it's just about a check of why that neck pain's there, obviously, because we're on Zoom for 100 hours a day now. But take the time to invest in yourself, to invest in a proper way of setting yourself up at your desk, but also standing up, and use your phone to set times to go for a walk, you know, to yell at you, to get out and stand and to go spend time with friends.
Yeah, it feels like during lockdown, we were living a more sedentary lifestyle, and we are learning more about how there's connections between physical health and mental health. And in your experience, have you found that there's a strong connection, through your study at least, between the poor physical health during the pandemic and how it affected their mental health?
Yeah, so we do track at Foundry at all the communities, the 11 sites that are open right now. We track a lot of that outcome, and certainly there's a strong correlation between that and the lack. The more active the individuals, it tends to be the higher mental health that they have, like in terms of good mental health and having better mental health. And I mean, we've known the science for that for a long time, right? You know, if you running releases the endorphins and makes you happy, and that's fantastic. But why don't we all run? You know, why are we not all running for an hour a day? And it's because there's some significant challenges and there's some things to process, and we're trying to process that. And I think a lot of us have spent a lot of time trying to process what's happening and what this new current norm is, that, oh, okay, I can't go to the gym now, so I won't go to the gym. And we haven't found other ways to replace it. Being from Montreal, I will tell you that this weather is pretty dandy out here. So even if it's raining, we should probably be getting out a little bit more. But I'm feeling like I'm the pot calling the kettle black, because I'm on my 13th hour straight here of Zoom with you guys. So
it's just so rainy these days.
Yeah. Get a rain jacket.
During the summer, actually, I took a lot of time. What I did practically every day, I would go outside cycling, and that was pretty nice. It's something that I actually didn't do as often before, but I guess now that the weather has changed, I have to figure out some alternative activities.
I think people have said, don't do this, but you know, a lot of people bought a dog. Just get a dog.
Yeah. I personally know someone who did that.
Exactly, to get them out. So if you don't want to buy a dog, go borrow someone's dog or something like that. Offer to take them for a walk. There's these little glimpses in Vancouver. You know, yesterday was a perfect one. There was this hour of no rain in the morning, and we went out for a walk, and the mountains were just gorgeous and so beautiful. And I feel like every time we see that, we think and look at UBC, like, what an unbelievable campus. And you just feel so lucky. Like, you just feel, you just all of a sudden you forget that it just rained for 57 days before that continuously, and you haven't seen the sky. But it's really important. This morning, actually, just on that note, random mental health thing, but this morning I have a little radio gig I do on the island. And the question was about Christmas. And I was like, what's better for you, Christmas lights or Christmas music? And there's some really new data coming up with Christmas lights and how good that is. And so if you're not seeing the sun, throw up some Christmas lights or warm lights of any kind, because it actually does a great thing for your mood at this time of year. So.
Yeah, that's pretty cool to hear. We'll be right back on Research Review after a promotional message and ad. So please stay tuned.
Let's see here. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody. God, this is awful. Isn't there anything? Anything? Anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
I really want to make a podcast. People? Well, we've got a huge opportunity to share with you. StoryHive is giving away 10 grants of $10,000 each to aspiring podcasters in BC and Alberta. Since 2013, TELUS StoryHive has funded and supported emerging creators with mentorship and guidance from the National Screen Institute, bringing hundreds of creative Western Canadian projects to life. This time, they're taken to the airwaves with their inaugural podcast edition, dropping on November 4th. StoryHive is looking for original nonfiction podcast concept pitches from BC and Alberta residents. Make sure you apply before December 2nd at storyhive.com, and you could get $10,000 to get your podcast off the ground. That's storyhive.com for all the details.
Great, so we're back now, and you're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC. I'm your co-host, Alirod, along with Gurman. So, Gurman, you have a couple of questions for Dr. Barbic, who we are interviewing today.
Yeah, so let's transition to your second research project that was going on, your little advisory committee on COVID-19 research. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, my little advisory committee is amazing, and they're big.
Yeah. Oh, wow, yeah.
No, but they're not. They're big in terms of big ideas, and I'm so humbled by the opportunity to work with them and trying to think about what it is that is so significant. So they were designed, you know, basically to inform researchers to make their research more youth-friendly, more youth-centered, and to help make sure that the research is mobilized into practice quickly. That's what it was for. But as researchers are coming to meet with them, we're learning that researchers don't know how to engage with young people very well. Like, we haven't been taught that, and we need to learn some skills about how to engage young people. And so in the same way that I've tried to, you know, bring this young people to this group of young people together and provide them the skills to help researchers, I've realized we have to provide researchers with the skills to listen to young people and to incorporate what they need. So the youth advisory panel right now is 11 members from all five health authorities from across the province, age 13 to 25. Over 50% identify as BIPOC and 50% as LGBTQ plus. And they bring very diverse perspectives across the whole range of the needs of the province. But they also have very clear agendas about not only how we have to like engage young people, but why aren't young people leading research? Like, why? What could we do to set up the environment for them to be like, hey, I have an idea. How can we support them to do the research? And I think it's just so brilliant. It's really changed my thinking about youth engagement, youth allyship. Like, how could I be an ally to young people to help use this privilege that I have a PhD to get the knowledge out? But how do we move out of that space or still stay a little bit in that space, but move towards creating environments that allow young people to thrive and set research agendas and answer their own research questions and get that knowledge into practice? So this little committee, your little panel, you know, its mission and vision was to really support research at the Faculty of Medicine and at UBC and to make it more youth-centered and get that knowledge into practice. But it's evolving only 3 months into it. It's really evolving into rethinking how we do research about young people. And maybe it's a bit ambitious for us at this time to start reimagining what the project should be only 3 months in. But I'm really quite excited about it because I do think, you know, if we're doing this just in the idea about COVID, and if we would have given young people the environment right at the beginning to design their own research questions and to answer those own research questions, I think we would have 8 months later had a whole science about youth and COVID that we would never have had. And I think some of those recommendations or those findings would have been implemented into practice. And we may have had some young people be more engaged in either whether it's, you know, abiding to masks or whether they're coming up with solutions for their own mental health and supporting their transitions in this difficult period. I think we would have had a lot more knowledge if we would have invested in the infrastructure to allow them to do the work from the beginning. So it's not too late. And I think it's giving us some learning about how better to do that and at UBC to be leaders in that. Because I don't think there are other places in the world who are thinking like this. So then UBC, U of T is starting to do really neat work. But we have a really great opportunity at UBC to be the global leaders in setting up the environment for young people to ask research questions, answer them, and implement the findings into practice and policy. Can I ask you guys a question? Am I allowed?
Yeah, of course.
So I'm going to ask you, sorry, I'm totally into this now, but like, why are young people not being asked to come to the table? Like, what do you guys think from your perspective? Why are young people not at the decision-making tables? And what are the consequences to that?
I would say perhaps it's just a broader issue of, as we see, you know, in politics, it tends to be dominated by older people. So the decisions are made by older people. And perhaps I would say it would also be connected to the same issue that is often said of low voter turnout in youth, whereas youth are generally less engaged with the community, with politics, with decision making compared to older generations. And I would say it's a pretty interesting question because there's definitely no solid single-pointed answer to it. What do you think, Ramon?
Yeah, my first instinct would just be that they're sort of just jaded towards the amount of like how little engagement there is towards the community and how they're just not being listened to, and they're just sort of just like, what's the point anymore of even trying? I feel like you need to take a lot of initiative just to get your voice heard even. So they're just, it's too difficult.
I guess sometimes there's the common trope of the, you know, the entitled millennial or entitled youth or, you know, the precious snowflakes or whatever else it's branded as. So it makes it seem like, you know, our concerns are probably not as valid, or it's like a lot of times it's definitely not that way all the time, but sometimes it might be viewed, or certain people might frame it as if it is that way.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. Like, I think there's a assumption that with age comes wisdom, and I think we need to debunk that and really empower young people to know that they do hold the wisdom and they do hold that knowledge, especially knowledge about young people, because as you age, you forget about it. And it's not the time to say, well, when I was a kid, it was like this, or they don't have it as hard as I do. This is the time to listen to young people and prioritize them, because you have the expertise. You're the first generation that's ever gone through something like this. And, you know, in my 40s and other researchers and politicians, I don't feel like we truly can assume that we know what's going on, because the knowledge is held with this group. So I think even at UBC, I'd love to see us prioritize young people at the decision-making tables and at the leadership tables. And I'd love to see our own government prioritize positions that are for young people, where young people can see themselves and identify and feel like Alirad's like got my back. Like, you know, I brought the messages, and you're gonna prioritize them with Mr. Horgan. But you're totally right. And that goes not just for young people, it goes for diverse voices and mm-hmm. different populations. Like, we need to see ourselves in politics. And as a white female researcher, I often see myself, you know, in middle-aged researcher in various positions in politics. But I know my daughter doesn't, and I know the people that I work with don't. And it causes this not only disempowerment, but almost, you're right, like, what's the point? I think, as you said, German, like, what's the point? And you don't want to have that in this generation right now. You want a generation that's clearly directed, knows their mission, and knows what their contribution is to society. And I just couldn't imagine a better group right now, especially at UBC. I'll be a little biased to lead this type of work. It's really time that we prioritize young people at the forefront of everything we do.
Definitely. And I would just say one last question is now looking to the future. Would you ever consider that, say, perhaps 10 years down the road, perhaps with the same group of people that you're studying right now, or maybe with a different group, and really doing a study where people reflect retrospectively on what impact COVID-19 had on their lives, perhaps like trying to see what the more long-term, more nuanced impacts might have been?
I think it's a great idea. Are we going to lead that study together? Are we going to
call you in 10 years?
Yeah, it'll probably be like a hologram call or something that we'll do. I'll just touch my microchip in my hand and it'll happen. I think we have to. I think we have to understand the long-term impact of this, because it's something like we haven't seen ever. It's not a, you know, people have been making the analysis or the analogy to World War II, and it's totally different. It's totally different. Even the analogy to the Spanish flu, you know, it's a completely different time. And it's a different time politically, it's a different time environmentally, it's in a different time social justice wise. And I think we have to study this over time, and we have to prioritize young people, because, you know, I think this is a group that is going to, these are the groups, like, the reason I'd want to engage them the most is not because I want to know how traumatic this was for you. I think I don't want to look back at that. I want to know how you left feeling empowered to solve the future complex, wicked problems that we have in the world. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's what I would be most interested in, is like, what did you leave, and what special superhero skills did you leave with that makes you resilient to tackle all the life's challenges moving forward? And I know we're going to have to provide, you know, more intense supported mental health and substance use support for a lot of young people moving forward. but I'm pretty certain, or I'm hypothesizing, I got to be a better scientist. I'm hypothesizing that we're going to have a really badass group of resilient people that come out of this, who are our future leaders, who will understand how to deal with complex, wicked problems that no other generation has done. And, you know, it's our responsibility to take that forward and not to tell our own kids, you know, 20 years down there. You can't imagine what it was like during the COVID times. Like, you have it so easy. You're a snowflake and all these things we're going to be telling them. I mean, like, you know, like, we just have to be, take the things that are kind of pissing us off a little bit as younger people, or as you guys as younger people, and kind of make a commitment moving forward that we're going to lead. We're going to lead in a really good way. And then when we do have the privilege of being parents or raising a family or being responsible for mentoring future generations, that we try not to go back into these lessons that are annoying us right now, or annoying young people. So I have one more question for you that came to me today. I thought it would be good for your show today.
Yeah, go for it.
Somebody asked me today, if 2020 was a scented candle, what would you be?
My God.
Which candle?
Lots of words I can't say on the radio.
Yeah, I was trying to think, like, my first response came up as, like, you know, a stinky shoe or a tire fire or something like that. But I think we, you know, I'm trying to think about what the smell of resilience looks like, and that would probably be the name of the candle for me. But I think we have to... we're not out of it. We're not even close to out of this, but we certainly have to start empowering the language that we use and changing the language that we use to, and 2021 is the time to have a new scented candle, I guess, or a new opportunity to shift the language. And it starts with you guys and everybody at UBC.
I mean, 2020 was just such a emotional roller coaster. I would say that it's hard to represent it with just one.
you have a layered candle then.
It's layered, definitely. Yeah. And I would say it was odd for me. Like in January 2020, I headed into a new term of classes, and my last term had gone pretty well, so I was super optimistic. I was like, 2020, let's get this year. And just then, and just progressively started getting worse in every single possible way.
But going into 2021, what are you feeling?
Cautious optimism, I would say. Yeah. I would say that, you know, with how things are still going on, it's definitely not improving at the current moment, but with the whole vaccine news, and I would say that having been in this situation for a few months now, it's that I feel like we're definitely adapting now a lot more. We're finding new ways, new coping strategies, so that definitely does give me optimism, and, you know, cautious optimism that in a few months it's not going to be an immediate return back to normal, but we're going to see step by step going back to where we were in 2019, perhaps. That's
that situation. Oh, what a lofty goal.
I think, why would we ever want to go back to 2019? Because we're actually really so much better now. Like, you know, what we learned. I don't want to go back. And that's been some of the peace I've tried to achieve. And one of my postdoc supervisors from Toronto, Quan McKenzie, said, we don't want to go back to 2019 because that was the time that, you know, race didn't matter. And in the environment, Greta hadn't done her environmental walk and the environment wasn't front and center. And so it was really interesting observation. And he's right. Like, we've come across, we've taken some time to process these big issues. Mm-hmm. And I think we now need to solve them. And we have responsibility of being better citizens and being better people and coming together to do that. So I personally don't want to go back to 2019, but
definitely.
I think 2021,
that's right.
Yeah, 2021 is where it's at. Let's just make it happen. So.
And I would say, yeah, it's just, I feel like I have a lot of, you know, pent up energy that's just ready to be released.
Yeah, New Year's is going to be good.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming onto the show. It was really enlightening to hear your perspective on things.
Thank you to you both for prioritizing youth mental health. It's been it's such an important topic, and I'm very thankful that you've been able to put it at the forefront of this conversation. It's very cool.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, we're hoping to interview some more people on the same topic very soon, so hopefully we'll get some more information out there.
Great. I'll be listening in.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM with Alirad, that's me, and my co-host Gurman. We'd like to thank Dr. Skye Barbic again for joining us on the show. That was a pretty nice interview. And to our listeners, we hope that you tune in again next week and see what else we have to offer. In the meantime, have a great week and see you back.